Well, good morning, TNC family, from my home to wherever you are on this holiday weekend. Today is going to be a great day because we are in for a memorable journey together as we do something we don't usually do. And I believe when we get to the end today, we're all going to be really, really grateful. But I want to start with this. If you've come around TNC for very long, you'll notice that we typically don't pray asking God to show up or inviting God's presence to come, as if he's somehow far away and in need of an invitation, which is, by the way, how too many people pray. Or, same point, different context. Sometimes folks have a cool, unexpected experience, and then when telling about it, we'll say, and then, right there, God showed up. And both scenarios make me think, where do you think God was before that? Before you invited him? Before he showed up? Because on the authority of Scripture, there is a better way to see God, a way in which we know that God is already with us, right here, right now, all the time. Which means our task isn't to beg God to come near. Rather, it's to wake up and see the world as it truly is, soaked with the divine, if we'll only stop and look and listen. And which is why one of the great experiences we had of divine presence last year was last January when we canceled our regular services and all went downtown to the Human and Civil Rights Museum in downtown Atlanta, where we learned about both the historic civil rights movement as well as ongoing efforts to protect human rights around the world today. Some of you will remember the Martin Luther King Jr. gallery on the bottom floor. No photos, no audio recordings, whispering only. And then, remember the main lobby where we saw the bold, colorful human rights mural, a collage of 20th century protest posters from around the world, surging outward from a raised, open hand? And I know many of you will never forget the gallery called Rolls Down Like Water, a gallery that transported us to the segregated South of the 1950s. Or upstairs, where we explored ongoing issues around the world, where Eleanor Roosevelt was featured, alongside her quote, "It isn't enough to talk about peace, one must believe in it. And it isn't enough to believe in it, one must work at it." Or Mahatma Gandhi's picture alongside this quote, "An eye for an eye will make the whole world blind." Well, today, since we remain in the middle of a pandemic making large gatherings difficult, I want to remember what this holiday weekend calls us to remember by inviting you on a different kind of field trip with me. Last week, I drove over 1,000 miles over the course of 3 days to various locations around the South, and I won't say more here. I'll just invite you to come there with me now. TNC family, I am talking to you now from Montgomery, Alabama, where there's a slight breeze in the air and it's very sunny today, and where I've spent the afternoon at three separate sites. First, the Freedom Rides Museum. Freedom Riders were groups of white and black civil rights activists who participated in Freedom Rides, bus trips, through the American South in 1961. To protest segregated bus terminals. And this museum is located inside the actual old Montgomery Greyhound bus station.
the site of a violent attack on participants on May 20, 1961. Second, I've spent time at the Rosa Parks Museum, located on the campus of Troy University at Montgomery. Rosa Parks, of course, is one of the most recognized figures of the civil rights movement and was a 42-year-old seamstress when she made history on December 1, 1955. And the third site I visited was Dexter Avenue Baptist Church. Orange bricked, dual white outdoor staircases leading to large brown double doors. But I'm actually talking to you now from a fourth location at the corner of Rosa Parks Avenue and Jefferson Davis Avenue. Jefferson Davis, of course, was the president of the Confederacy, and he was inaugurated at Montgomery State Capitol in 1861. And so you heard that right. I'm at the intersection of Rosa Parks Avenue and Jefferson Davis Avenue. I'm literally looking up at the ironic, perhaps profound, juxtaposition of two green signs. Rosa L. Parks Avenue, which runs north-south, and West Jefferson Davis Avenue, which runs east-west. Now, you likely remember much of the story. It was 5 p.m. on a Thursday, and Rosa Parks had just clocked out of work and walked to Court Square to wait for her bus home after another hard day. She described later that, quote, her body ached and her feet were swollen from the constant standing at her job. But on that December day, the bus stand was packed. So instead of pushing for a rush hour seat, she crossed over Dexter Avenue to do a little shopping at Lee's Cut-Rate Drugstore, where she purchased a few small Christmas gifts along with some aspirin and toothpaste before heading back to the bus stop for the ride home, where she would greet her husband, a barber at the Maxwell Air Force Base barbershop, and they, along with her mother, Leona, who lived with them, would eat dinner together. And so, sometime later, she dropped her dime in the box and boarded the olive-yellow bus and took an aisle seat in the racially neutral middle section behind the movable sign, which read, colored. And she was not expecting any problems, as there were several empty spaces in the white-only front of the bus. In fact, a black man was sitting next to her on her right, and across the aisle, two black women sat. Surprisingly, though, at the next two stops, enough white passengers got on to nearly fill up the front section, so that at the third stop, in front of the Empire Theater, the last front seats were taken, with one white man left standing. And so the bus driver turned around and addressed all the folks in her aisle and said, "Everyone, move! We need those seats!" An order, of course, given on the authority of Jim Crow, which dictated that all four people in that row of the middle section would have to surrender their seats to accommodate the single white man, because no colored folks were allowed to sit parallel with a white person. Reluctantly, the two black women sitting across from Parks rose and moved to the back. Quickly, her seatmate followed suit. She remembers swinging her legs to the side to let him out. After which, Rosa Parks slid over to the window seat and stared out. 10 seconds later, the driver was standing over her. "Are you going to stand up?" Rosa Parks looked straight at him. "No." "Well, I'm going to have you arrested." "You may do that." And she was arrested, fingerprinted, mugshot taken, belongings confiscated, a drink of water denied, and put in jail. And my guess is, TNC, that we will be tempted to be numb to the shock and outrage of that last sentence. She did not stand up, and they handcuffed her, arrested her, threw her in jail, deprived her of even a drink of water. But that Thursday evening would inspire and mark the beginning of the Montgomery bus boycott, a 381-day boycott of the city's bus system, organized through meetings hosted by the pastor of the Dexter Avenue Baptist Church, a man named Martin Luther King Jr. And earlier today, at the Dexter Avenue Baptist Church, where King was pastor from 1954 to 1960, I saw the stairs and the steeple and the stained glass, the church where that young pastor, alongside Rosa Parks, helped launch a movement. It's interesting, TNC, because Rosa Parks had met King just 4 months before, on August 14, 1955, when she attended an NAACP meeting at the Metropolitan United Methodist Church on Jefferson Davis Avenue. So, who would have thought? On that August day, when Rosa Parks first met Dr. King, that these two folks would become perhaps the most recognized names of the civil rights movement. And so today has been an important day for me, visiting the museums and this church. But in some ways, the well-laid-out museum and the shimmering stained glass did not speak louder to me than this simple green sign on this ordinary-looking street. Because simply learning the history and peering into the past is not enough, which is why Rosa L. Parks Avenue is a beautiful metaphor, because it's not just a present-day roadway for cars, it's a roadway for hearts and minds and hands and feet and wallets and words, because it's a reminder and a clarion call for me, and I hope for you, that we together can make a difference. This day, this era, because God will work through everyday routines, commutes and conversations, and along common pathways to achieve uncommon, divine advancements. As historian Eldridge Cleaver wrote in his famous and shocking memoir called Soul on Ice, about that December 1 winter day, quote, somewhere in the universe, a gear in the machinery shifted. Because within a year after the Montgomery bus boycott, 42 other local movements were organized in the South to combat racial segregation. Not that it was smooth sailing, as you know, because Rosa Parks received a barrage of death threats, and many more would give their lives in the fight for equal justice. But a gear in the machinery shifted that day. And it's true, the arc of the moral universe bent a little more toward justice. Because here I stand at the intersection of Rosa L. Parks Avenue and West Jefferson Davis Avenue, a place where two roads meet. And while there is always more work to be done, this sign reminds me that Rosa L. Parks Avenue directs you and me along the better way. And this is the story of the sign and the inspiration of Rosa Parks. But now we need to head to another destination, another state, actually, because we have another story to consider, the story of four lunch counter stools. Well, I'm sitting here now inside the old Woolworth retail building in Greensboro, North Carolina, F.W. Woolworth was the largest retail discount department store in the entire world in the 1950s, 60s, and beyond. And this one, YM Now, was one of the largest of their retail stores. And it, like others, welcomed everyone to shop, spend money, buy goods, toys, kitchen supplies, gardening tools, sewing material, beauty products, candy, more. Exchange their product for your money across one of the many checkout counters in the store. Now, they also served food at a long lunch counter, 65 light blue and light red stools, alternating colors, a long line, each with short silver backrests. But while anyone could buy toothpaste and socks and gum and so on, Woolworths, in fact, all of Greensboro, in fact, much of our nation, didn't allow black folks to sit and eat at this counter. Which is why I woke up this morning and made the five-hour drive from Atlanta to meet with John Swain and LaTanya Wiley and the team here at the Greensboro International Civil Rights Center and Museum. The museum, located inside the building that used to be the H.W. Woolworth store, now with 30,000 square feet and 13 permanent galleries devoted to telling the story of the Greensboro Four. The Greensboro Four, David Richmond, Franklin McCain, Ezell Blair Jr., and Joseph McNeil, were black students at North Carolina Agricultural and Technical State University who, on February 1, 1960, sat down on these stools at this Woolworth lunch counter and asked for the same service as that given white customers, but were denied it, launching the famous sit-ins and even more the civil rights movement of the 1960s. And listen, friends, it's been an emotional and important several hours here. And I'll tell you how I feel. I feel heavy, sad, that a human being could walk into a store and ask for a sandwich and be refused because of the color of their skin. I feel so sad learning again and learning anew about what took place in this building. We're literally just a few feet from where I'm speaking. I can see and touch the original counter and the original stools and the original salt and pepper shakers, the plates and napkin holders. I feel so sad being in this room at this counter. But I also feel hopeful. One of the exhibits I walked through was the exhibit that included a dorm room that looked exactly like the dorm room of two of the four students, two beds, one with the green blanket and one with the blue, and a desk with pencils, where these four students, four human beings like you and me, who liked pizza and books and sports and movies and hanging out with friends, decided that they could no longer live with the moral contradiction of being refused service at one counter while being catered to at a dozen others inside the same retail store. Joseph McNeil told his friends in that dorm room one night, "It's time we take some action. We talk a lot, but engage in very little action." And so on the Sunday night before that famous Monday, listen to this, Ezell Blair Jr. came home and asked his parents if they would be embarrassed if he got into trouble. Why, his parents wondered. "Because," he said, "tomorrow we're going to do something that will shake up this town." "All of us were afraid," David Richmond recalled, "but we went and did it." And what they did that next day was peaceful, but it was purposeful and persistent. And what they did launched an historic journey that ignited a decade of civil rights conversations and legislation. And what they did was walk into downtown Greensboro, enter this local Woolworth here where I'm sitting, purchase a few items from one counter of the retail store, and then walk to this lunch counter sit on these stools and order a cup of coffee and a sandwich. But they were given no service, ignored at first, then told to leave, which they did not. They remained on those stools until the store closed. And then the next day, they came back, this time joined by 21 other men and 4 women, also students. And then on Wednesday morning, 63 students showed up and took up all but 2 available stools at Woolworth. And then on Thursday, for the first time, 3 white women, college students from another campus, joined the demonstrations. And by Friday, it was clear that a spontaneous action by a few had triggered a massive social movement. Which is not to say that it was smooth sailing, because they were met by angry white folks and some members of white gangs waving Confederate flags. Gang members who heckled them, screamed at them, threatened them, and many were arrested. Oh, not the threateners, but the threatened, despite the nonviolent nature of their protest. But 7 days after these demonstrations started in Greensboro, students in Winston-Salem and Durham held sit-ins at local lunch counters. And by April 28, sit-ins had spread to Texas and to Maryland. And by July, it had spread to 54 cities and 9 states. But it all began on these padded light blue stools and these padded light red stools. And as I sit here and look at these stools, I think about what they stand for, because they don't just represent the sit-in movement. And let me be real direct, TNC. They also tell a story of hatred and exclusion and inferiority, not of a United States, but of, in the words of Abraham Lincoln, a house divided, a country at war with itself. These stools, this counter, tell the story of how too many believed that all men and women are not created equal. But the stools also tell another story, the story of a community, churches, schools, clubs, and business organizations, and how they came together in response to the Greensboro Four to inspire a civil rights revolution throughout American hearts and homes. Because these Greensboro demonstrations came to be seen as part of a larger, continuing struggle to overcome racism. And these Greensboro demonstrations inspired other peaceful, yet powerful demonstrations and marches. During one such peaceful march in Greensboro, over 2,000 participated, and among those were a group of college students and school principals, and 26 ministers, and dozens of doctors and nurses and teachers, and hundreds of factory and retail workers and average citizens. One woman who marched, Nell Coley, marched in high heels. And she was asked by a reporter why she was marching in high heels. And she said, because it didn't matter much or hurt much, because, quote, it feels like my feet have wings. A beautiful metaphor, I think, because what she meant, of course, was that what started on a stool went to the streets, where ordinary feet and extraordinary courage took flight, and the dream of equality reached the skies over our country. Which is why the Greensboro sit-ins are the best-known sit-ins of the Civil Rights Movement, a movement in which 70,000 people participated, a movement that saw Greensboro businesses and businesses across our entire nation desegregate lunch counters. And what's so powerful, I think, to realize here, TNC, is that it was a movement of ordinary folks. I'm saying the surge for racial justice in North Carolina came not from the city hall in Greensboro, nor from the state capitol in Raleigh. It took wings from one stool and one street in Greensboro, and then 2 streets. and then hundreds. It took wings among young and old, black and white, men and women who acted to realize a vision of justice too long deferred. And being here helps me realize that the story of social change is not just a national story told from the perspective of national policies and leadership from the top down. It's the story of social change from the point of view of people in local communities where the struggle for civil rights was a day-to-day reality, year in and year out. It's the story of leadership from the bottom up, if you will. And there's great hope in that, because that means that this story can be my story and yours. I'm saying we are part of this movement that goes on. Whenever we sit down on stools and benches and chairs, whenever we sit down next to people different from us, and we humbly listen and we learn. And then when we choose to speak up and stand up and share and give and sacrifice and include and serve and love and discover that we all are equal, all endowed by our Creator with certain inalienable rights. And this is the story of these stools and the inspiration of the Greensboro Four. And now I'm going to get back into my car and head home, because we have another place to stop and another story to consider, the story of a flame. And now, as I talk to you, I'm sitting outside in front of the Eternal Flame, downtown in our hometown at the Martin Luther King Jr. Center for Nonviolent and Social Change. It's a cold morning here, but just a few paces from this flame, others are gathering at the tomb of Dr. and Mrs. King, where there's also a beautiful reflecting pool surrounded by cobblestone paths and benches. The flame that's right in front of me, of course, is a powerful symbol of the ongoing nature of the effort to realize Dr. King's dream. It's a dream that still burns. And despite the sound of water fountains and birds and folks walking by, it's plenty quiet here, leaving room for a flood of thoughts and a clarity of conscience. I remember when I was a teenager, my family visited Washington, D.C. And one morning, my parents took me to the famous Washington National Cathedral to hear and experience a musical concert, specifically the sound of the great organ there. It's four keyboard manuals, foot pedal, and 10,250 pipes. It's also, of course, an architectural masterpiece with its Gothic spires and carved angels and 215 stained glass windows. It's also the cathedral of presidents and dignitaries who have visited it from all over the world. But I mention it now here because it is also the cathedral where Martin Luther King Jr. spoke on March 31, 1968, 2 weeks before Easter that year. And he spoke from behind the ornate Canterbury pulpit and gazed out across the massive nave. And he gave a famous sermon summoning his listeners to the eternal work of the gospel of Jesus Christ. And I want to read to you from it now, just a few sentences, as I sit by the eternal flame. Because I think you'll hear that it's a message still burning in our time. He said from that pulpit, "One of the great liabilities of life is that all too many people find themselves living amid a great period of social change, and yet they fail to develop the new attitudes, the new mental responses that the new situation demands. They end up sleeping through a revolution." And then he went on, "We are tied together in a single garment of destiny, caught in an inescapable network of mutuality. And whatever affects one directly affects all indirectly. For some strange reason, he said, I can never be what I ought to be until you are what you ought to be. And you can never be what you ought to be until I am what I ought to be. This is the way God's universe is made. This is the way it is structured. And it was a famous sermon that day, made more famous, you might know this, because King would be dead before the week was out. That was his final Sunday sermon. 4 days later, King would be martyred by an assassin's bullet outside a motel room in Memphis, April 4, 1968. 5 days later, on April 9, there was a private funeral service followed by the loading of King's casket onto a simple wooden farm wagon pulled by two mules, and then the procession made its way 3.5 miles to Morehouse College, 100,000 people lining the streets along the way. At the funeral service, Baptist minister Benjamin Mays delivered the eulogy, and he concluded with these remarks, quote, I close by saying to you what Martin Luther King Jr. believed. If physical death was the price he had to pay to rid America of prejudice and injustice, nothing could be more redemptive. And so permit me to say that Martin Luther King Jr.'s unfinished work on earth must truly be our own. Which is why TNC, the flame still burns. Because the work is ours now. This is our era. And so on this holiday weekend, Martin Luther King Jr.'s work lives on in the hearts and minds and words and deeds of every one of us who live out the creed that all men are created equal. Who live out the creed that we will do unto others as we'd have them do unto us. Who live out the creed that all the law and all the prophets hang on these two. Love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength, and love your neighbor as yourself. And to live out the prayer that Jesus taught us to pray. Your kingdom come, O God, your will be done on earth as it is in the heavens. Because after all, it's not Martin Luther King Jr.'s eternal flame. It's the flame of the eternal. It's the divine flame that calls us to carry on the work of human equality and dignity. It's the divine flame that urges us to see others as God sees them, which means not as enemies or threats, or as the opposition or the other side, not as objects to be used, played, feared, controlled, managed, exploited, but as God sees them, as image bearers of the divine. Which is why Jesus himself prayed, John 17, may they be one even as we are one, so that the world may believe that you have sent me. And TNC, that's a prayer about you and me, about us today. It's Jesus's prayer that we would treat one another with a spirit of humility and respect and servanthood and love, that we would be known not as Republicans or Democrats, not first as Americans or Smiths or Joneses or Williamses or Millers or Baptists or Catholics or Seventh-day Adventists or Methodists, but as children of God, as the family of God. And so this weekend, this day, I want to pray with you now from this flame. God, will you help each of us to lead the way in speaking words of healing and in extending arms of grace? And in creating a world where every human can take gulps of freedom and leaps of faith and treasures full of hope. This weekend, we remember the flame, and we carry on the flame. This weekend, we remember the love and the dignity that you have given each of us, a love and dignity we pledge to pass along to everyone in our paths. Amen.
Well, I hope you've enjoyed and been encouraged by this journey as much as I have. I'm reminded that in the scriptures, the prophet Joel counsels a people he loves. Chapter 1, quote, "Tell it to your children, and let your children tell it to their children, and their children to the next generation." Because Joel wants us to know, it's important to remember stories, to be moved by them and inspired by them and encouraged by them. Because human beings throughout history, TNC, are far more alike than different. And so remembering and telling is so helpful and hopeful if we'll let it be. Because while our lives might reflect distinct and diverse journeys, our dreams tend to be pretty similar. Dreams for joy and peace and connection and dignity and redemption and progress. And I pray that these dreams become a few steps closer to our reality this weekend.